Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Hi, this is John Christopher for Real Life, and today I have as my guest Taylor Rose Berry, who is the owner of Harbor Books in Sag Harbor. Hey, Taylor Rose, how are you?
Hi, John. I'm good. How are you?
I'm wonderful. You know, I always like to hear about the sojourns that we take through life, so tell us about your sojourn to opening books. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Babylon Village, which is a tiny fishing, surfing village on the south shore of Long Island, not unlike Sag Harbor, really. And I was in the restaurant industry. And when I moved out here, I didn't want to do that anymore. So I decided to work at the local bookstore. And then a few years later, I opened my own.
Wow. So now that leads me into the next question. What was the motivation to open a bookstore when so many publishers are having difficulty just maintaining being a publisher?
Absolutely. I think that, well, there's two parts to that. The first is that Sag Harbor at one point had between 5 and 6 bookstores. And last year, Canio's was the last one standing. And I think in a literary community like Sag Harbor, it's so sad that there would only be one. So since I had decided to make my life in Sag Harbor, I thought that the best way I could contribute to the community would be to bring another bookstore in. At the end of the day, independent bookstores are up in sales 3.9% just in June alone. They're up about 8% every year for the past 3 years. So they're doing well, and I think that indies are on the rise. So
that's fantastic. I just wasn't aware of that. So in other words, like the big guys,
Barnes & Noble, Borders, Amazon, the bad guys.
They're going by the wayside.
They are. I think that what indies do in a way that the big box stores and Amazon can't is we know essentially the unique quirks of our communities, and we could provide a service that they just can't. So when Amazon leads in mass market paperbacks, most independent bookstores will lead in nonfiction and fiction hardcovers. So we could sustain in a way that, not that they can't, but it's just a different breed entirely. It's a different animal. And again, there's 51 new independent bookstores according to the ABA this year. So
that's great.
Well, I'm happy about it.
That's
encouraging. I'm not the only crazy one, as it turns out.
No. You know, we were talking earlier about how the New York Times influences books that you order.
Can you
explain that or elaborate on that
Absolutely.
A little bit?
Absolutely. So obviously, the New York Times every Sunday has their book review, and I can without fail say that on Sunday morning, those are the books that will sell out. The Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal do it as well, but there's something about the Times bestseller list that people want to know. I think that you're probably not allowed at a dinner party if you haven't read a few of them or something like that. But they I'm able to get what's going to be reviewed earlier in the week. I make sure that we order it, and then we go from there, and people want to read those books.
Even though you think some of the books are so-so, correct?
Some of the books I think are so-so. I don't always agree with the reviews,
right.
Good or bad. Sometimes I think reviews that they review poorly, I absolutely love, as do my booksellers. I think that that's an opinion thing, though, no matter what you're
reviewing.
But
you have to have them.
You got to have them, no matter what. Oh. If I don't have them, people will not be happy with me. And often, the books aren't even published yet. They'll review in advance, and people don't believe us when we say that. I swear they're not published yet. But the New York Times reviewed it, but they're not published yet.
You know, it's interesting. I had that experience with your bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't there at the time, but I went in there because I had read something. It's actually a friend of mine had written a book, Michael Schneerson. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, great. I'll go and get the book. And of course, they said the book's not there.
Not in yet.
And I said, yeah, but I saw it reviewed.
And again, you probably didn't believe my booksellers.
Right, I didn't.
But you think that we're just making it up. But they do that often. This week's book review, I think about 50% are not out until Tuesday. So
what do you do with these people? They're coming in thinking the book should be there.
I swear to them that it's not out yet, and I take their order. So if they want to order it in advance, we'll take their name, we'll give them a call. Usually the books come in for us Monday night.
Oh.
So Tuesday morning, they'll get the phone call. Tuesday's the big pub day in the publishing world. So they'll get the phone call Tuesday morning. They could come up, pick up their copy.
Oh, that's great. Now, I remember the Paris Hilton once had said, when the waiter gave her a menu, she said, "I don't read." Do you think there's like a decline with reading, or do you think that's still that's just, you know,
Yeah, I think that it's a good thing her grandfather didn't think that. no, and if she's the representative of my generation, I'm terrified. But the Pew Research Center did a study recently, and they said that 53% of millennials have read at least one book in the past year, and 75% of them read real books versus 19% that read on e-readers, and I think 12 that listen to audiobooks. So I'd like to think that she's in the minority. I certainly can say
that. Yeah, but one book a year, that's it?
Well, they talk about, one book a year. I think that in the age where 140 characters is the way that everyone's used to communicating, when you're reading so much articles, millennials read more news apparently than anybody else as well. It was a few years ago in 2006, 60% a day, and it's up to 89% a day now. So wow. I think we're reading. Reading books, I think you read in a different way. But they're still reading. And if I could comment on what I see at Harbor Books, I mean, millennials, people I could assume are millennials, walk in constantly and not only comment that they love real books, but that they're reading. I see it more than any other age range.
Wow, so, that's great. That's
encouraging. And the little ones, too.
And the kids.
The little kids. My children's section, which we affectionately call the Lands Beyond from the Phantom Tollbooth, is bopping all the time. The little kids love to read.
Is it because of the kids bopping, or is it?
It's both. It's certainly, they do bop. We have, beanbag chairs that they enjoy.
Well, speaking of Harbor Books, you have an idea, a concept about bringing in a salon into Harbor Books, the notion of a salon, I should say. Tell me about that.
So I guess I've probably always been a little bit obsessed with history. And in the 17th and 18th century, salons came into fashion as a place where people could exchange knowledge and discuss everything. It was the brilliant minds of the times all, got together and ate and drank and talked and debated and everything. Women like Isabel d'Este would host these incredible nights. Even as recent as the 1940s with Gertrude Stein, which if I could go to one of her salons with Hemingway and Fitzgerald, I would be in my glory. But I think there's something so incredible about having people with different views and different life experiences really just talking about knowledge. And in a bookstore, you're surrounded by the knowledge of the ages and you get to pull from that. So what better place to have that where you could walk in and there could be, whether it be the booksellers or customers or writers and artists or everyone, just discussing and really progressing society in a way.
What do you think it would be like, a book club? I mean, would you do it every week? What are your thoughts?
Different than a book club. I think that a book club is something that meets once a week or however often that they choose to meet. I think my concept of the idea of the salon is that it's just the soul of the store, that it could be happening at any moment. Like I said, Isabel d'Este, her home was open. She had truly her parlor, and you could walk in at any time, and she always had food out, and she always had, her servants, so to say, there to serve the people that came. And it
so you're going to have food and a little wine or
eventually,
something?
Eventually, maybe.
Ooh.
It's not official. there might be wine there at all times, but eventually we will have a cafe. That's the goal. Oh. I want to build that. I want it to be a place where you could get everything.
Right.
So
I think that's really fantastic. So tell us, where is Harbor Books, and how can someone get in touch with you to find out about this salon concept?
We are located at 20 Main Street in Sag Harbor Village, and you could stop in the store. You could reach us at any of our social media, which is Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, at Harbor Books SGH. We have a website, which is harborbookssgh.com, or you could call us at 631-808-3401.
Fantastic. Taylor Rose, it's been delightful having you on the program, and this is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with our next guest, Mike Ferrugia, partner of Ferrugia and Callisto. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is John Christopher, and today I have as my guest Mike Ferrugia, who is the partner of Ferrugia and Callisto, and also, interestingly enough, an expert on TRID, T-R-I-D. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Great, John. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to talking about TRID because I think there's a lot of people, especially agents, agencies, and lawyers, that are still in the dark about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau implementing a regulation with this acronym, TRID. First of all, can you tell us, what is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau?
Sure, John. The CFPB, as it's commonly known as, is a new executive regulatory agency that was established under the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act in 2010. Since 2012, when the CFPB really started amping up, their actions in the industry has increased hundredfold each and every year. They're becoming quite the player in real estate transactions all across the country.
Where did they get their funding from?
Well, that's probably one of the biggest complaints about the CFPB is that because they are an executive agency within the Federal Reserve, they don't have a budget, so to speak. It's more or less a blank check. And when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of money that this agency can spend in the enforcement of their own regulations, it does kind of come into some criticism.
So what does TRID stand for?
TRID stands for, forgive me, John, there's acronyms within the acronym, I didn't design it.
We'll leave it to the government, right?
Exactly. The T stands for the Truth in Lending Act. The R stands for RESPA, or the Real Estate Settlement and Procedures Act, Integrated Disclosures. So TRID stands for the TILA RESPA Integrated Disclosure Rules.
So is TRID eliminating anything? Or?
Oh, sure. Before the enforcement of the TRID or the effectiveness of the TRID regulations, a borrower who's seeking mortgage financing, they would be provided by their lender an initial good faith estimate, an initial truth in lending, and then at closing they would get final good faith estimates and final truth in lendings, and then what most people are familiar with, the HUD-1 settlement statements. So all of those are now gone. And they are all replaced with two disclosures that the CFPB has designed. The first is called the LE, or the loan estimate. And the second is, it's called the closing disclosure, or CD. And the LE is designed to be provided to the borrower at least within 3 business days after they submit a loan application. And the biggest change is the providing of the CD. This closing disclosure is all the final numbers that a borrower will realize upon closing. And the biggest shift here is that that disclosure is being provided to the borrowers a minimum of 3 business days before closing, which I think is a wonderful thing.
So in the final disclosure there, the buyer has the opportunity to see who all the players are, correct? And also what their final tally will be in closing costs, I imagine.
Okay? Correct. Yes.
Now, one of the things that I find interesting, which in the past, before this came into effect, if there was any discrepancies, attorneys had the ability, when I say discrepancies, maybe they were off a few cents someplace, or there was something that hadn't been addressed, and they said, okay, we'll put that in escrow. We'll hold that in escrow and then deal with it after the closing. That now is no longer possible. Is that correct?
Well, not necessarily, but it's certainly not best practice.
Okay.
The whole underlying theme under TRID and the CFPB, for that matter, is transparency, uniformity in the industry. And with those in mind, if attorneys are setting up side escrow agreements at the closing without the proper procedure of disclosing them to the lender, that could be questionable conduct. And that's why it's ultimately important that counsel now more than ever really take the extra time to educate their clients as to what is expected of them at the closing so that these can be avoided entirely.
So what you're saying now, attorneys should be aware of TRID so that they can facilitate the transaction process and move it along. If there's any... They only have 3-day windows is what basically along the way.
That's for the lender. Sure. In order for the lender to meet that 3-day window, that means all the practitioners have to supply information in a sufficient period of time so that the lender is able to do so. What that's going to ultimately result in is that once these TRID loans start closing, we are going to have to schedule them pretty far in advance.
Let me ask this question. I know a lot of times people lock in rates say we'll use a buyer in this instance. The buyer doesn't have an attorney who's versed in TRID. Mm-hmm. So you're moving all the way along. You're saying, okay, we're at the closing. And of course, there's some documentation that's missing. What happens? Do they go back to the beginning again and in the process have to go through this? And time-wise, could they lose the lock-in?
It's certainly possible. And under TRID, they would not have gotten that far. They would not have gotten to the closing if all the documentation was not in place a sufficient period of time before closing so that the lender can generate these disclosures.
Interesting. Okay. So how did you become aware of TRID?
Well, John, I've been teaching and speaking about Dodd-Frank and all its related issues as it affects the real estate market for several years now. I've had a 3-hour course on Dodd-Frank alone, and doing so, I've been very aware of the CFPB and very aware that these new regulations were coming down the pike. So we've kept a very close eye on them, and they're now finally in effect.
Right. So your recommendations that agents and agencies and attorneys become aware of TRID, I imagine.
Without question.
Right.
It's a whole new world.
So, Mike, you have offices in Southampton and Central Islip. Is there another way somebody could reach you if they have questions about TRID or want to employ your legal expertise?
Of course. They can contact my assistant, Josephine, at 631-232-0030.
What is that again? One more time.
631-232-0030. She's at 201, and she can schedule a personal consultation, or you can email me at info@fclawfirm.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the program, Mike.
Thank you, John.
You're quite welcome. This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back with my next guest, writer and author of Dodge City, Tom Clavin. Welcome back to Real Life. This is your host, John Christopher, and today I have as my guest, Tom Clavin, who is the writer and author of Dodge City. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm so happy to have you back again, because the last time you were on, we had to cut it a little short, so we didn't really get a chance to talk about Dodge City. So let's focus on Dodge City now, okay? You were saying that I was saying that Dodge City was considered the wickedest town of the West. You have that in your title.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can reiterate why that was the case. Why was Dodge City the wickedest and most deprived, and also I'm reading here, the most deprived and criminal town in the nation?
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, you had this volatile combination of alcohol, cowboys, and guns. And women.
I was just going to say, wasn't there any cat houses?
Yeah, cat houses. And that's where the women who frequented them were known as soiled doves.
Soiled doves.
So soiled doves, guns, alcohol, cowboys were a combustible mixture. And there was no law and order, really. You know, there was and the people who originally started their businesses, the saloon keepers, the gambling halls, obviously the proprietors of the bordellos, for example, they didn't want any curbs on this because they couldn't make money fast enough. You know, the cowboys would be on the trail for 6, 8, 10 weeks. The cows would be sold. They'd get paid off. They've got pockets full of money. And they wanted to drink, and they wanted to socialize and raise all kind of heck. And without, with the absence of law and order, there was really nobody to stop them.
So when you say, so was it, there were no sheriffs, there were nothing, there was nothing?
There was no law enforcement in Dodge City. There was an attempt
so
once.
So what would happen? Somebody goes and they get drunk and they pull out their gun, they shoot somebody?
They settle their things themselves. That's how Boot Hill, you know, was originated. There were a couple of cowboys on top of this hill that overlooked Dodge City. And they got into a fight and they took out their guns. One killed the other and then left. And the next morning there was this cowboy found stretched out on Boot Hill with his boots, you know, his toes pointing up. They dug a grave, threw him in it, and that became the town cemetery, Boot Hill.
And that began it.
That's how Boot Hill began. And so there was no law to go to. There were no judges. There was none of that system. And finally, the Dodge City lawmakers, city council, they were warned by the Texas ranchers, listen, my guys are getting killed. You got to do something. You got to clamp it down a little bit. And they had this guy named Bully Brooks that they put a badge on. And what they didn't realize is he was a psychopath. So in the first few months that he was the marshal, he shot and killed 12 people. So they said, well, this is getting worse. This is not the cure by any means. So they fired him and some of his disgruntled relatives of people that he killed, tracked him down and hung him. So, but that's where it opened the door, so to speak, for Wyatt Earp and then Bat Masterson to come to Dodge City and try something different, to actually work as peace officers. The goal was peace. Don't kill them faster than they're going to kill you. Try and bring some peace to it. Didn't happen overnight, but that's a lot of what the book is about, because these guys, Wyatt and Bat, in their 20s, they're 20-something guys, they were best friends, and they patrolled the streets together as lawmen. And they eventually, you know, they did bring law and order to Dodge City, in the wickedest town in the American West. Today, if you go there, it's one of the tamest towns in it's not even the West anymore, really. Right. It's Kansas still.
So what do you think that they became legends, or were they legends? They were legends at their time.
Not really. No? I mean, later. I thought Wyatt Earp did not become... I mean, it was gunfight at the OK Corral and Tombstone, right, that put Wyatt Earp on the map. And that's 10 years in the future, when he was an established lawman and he had his Virgil with him and Morgan and Earp brothers. Dodge City is where he was still trying to figure out what a lawman does. You know, he's only 20-something years old. Same thing with Bat Masterson. He was only 24. He was elected sheriff of Ford County. These guys were figuring out as they made it up as they went along. And at any point, they could have said, you know what, this job is too dangerous. We're out of here. But they didn't. They stuck to it because they felt this ideal of this is what the future of America is, law and order. But it was really years later.
So how were they persuasive in the sense that, okay, you've got two drunk guys, they're at the bar, mm-hmm, and alcohol, you know,
yeah,
changes your judgment values. Mm-hmm. How do you persuade somebody?
Well, for one thing, they could draw faster than anybody else, so they had the gun out before somebody else can get their gun out. Also, Wyatt was 6 feet tall. Now, today, that wouldn't be impressive, but in the 1870s, you're a good 6 inches taller than the average male. And he was a tough guy. He had trained as a boxer, and he had a tactic called buffaloing, which is where somebody looked like they might want to square off or cause some trouble. He would whip his gun out, and he'd crack them on top of the head with the barrel of it. He would, you know, swing it down on top of somebody's head, knock him out, drag him off to jail. In the morning, they wake up with a terrible headache and a hangover. They'd pay a fine, and they leave. And so they became feared, not because they killed people. You know, people were killed, but, I mean, their way of policing was not to kill people, but was to instill some fear and say, these guys are tough guys. And the other thing they did, which they were able to impose eventually, was you couldn't bring a gun into Dodge City. You had to leave your gun outside, you had to, or drop it off at the marshal's office or whatever. And that made a long way towards bringing some law and order, because no matter how drunk and angry you got, the most you could do was just start swinging away at each other. And that changed things a lot. So there were very, very few shootings after one of the most dramatic and one of the last shootings in Dodge City was when Ed Masterson was killed, Bat's brother. And that's a dramatic part of the book, because that's one of the few times that Bat lost his cool and lost his temper. And he gunned down the two guys that killed his brother. So, but for the most part, the story of Dodge City is the story of the American frontier and how it started to get tamed by lawmen who really started to really have a lot of integrity and actually believe that law and order is better than chaos.
Wow. So how do you research a book like this? I mean, do you go out to Dodge City? Did you go and
sure.
look at archives and stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, Dodge City, the people of Dodge City are wonderful folks, and they have, you have the Boot Hill Museum, you have the Kansas City Historical Society. The toughest part is that over the decades, a lot has been written that is either embellished or completely untrue, especially about Wyatt Earp. It's not a lot about Bat Masterson. Everybody seems to know the name. But what was he actually? And that was part of the fun of the book, to find out what an amazing career and person he was. With Wyatt Earp, a lot of the stuff that's passed down through the years in books and especially in movies is just not true. So it wasn't so much.
Yeah, but wasn't there a series on Bat Masterson?
There was with Gene Barry. A couple of years in the late 1950s.
Right,
yeah,
right.
But otherwise, there's very, very few books that you would ever that Bat Masterson is in. In the movies, if he appeared at all, it was a very short part, and mostly he was holding Wyatt's coat for him while Wyatt did the real work. And to find out that Bat Masterson actually had a longer and more effective career than Wyatt Earp did, and then ended up spending the last 15 to 20 years of his life as a newspaper reporter in New York City, he had an amazing life, and that was part of the fun of doing this book, to reveal the man behind the familiar name, right. what an astonishing life he had.
Well, the thing that's more astonishing is that he lived to such a long period, because mm-hmm. if you're in that environment, numbers sometimes, are
exactly.
against you.
Well, I could, in Dodge City, talk about the where these guys ended up. I mean, Bat Masterson, like I said, he died at his desk banging out a column at the New York Herald Tribune in New York. Wyatt Earp lived to be 80, and his last years were spent living in Hollywood, where he was a technical advisor, so to speak, to this young director making silent westerns named John Ford.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Just quickly before we wrap this up, you're working on a new book. What can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's a couple of books that are coming out. I have one that came out in May called Being Ted Williams, which I wrote with Dick Enberg, the sports broadcaster, and he passed away just as we finished it, but it's a book all about his hero worship of Ted Williams. And then in October,
he was an amazing guy.
He was an amazing guy and a terrific ball player, I think.
Right.
The book, I think, will remind people what an amazing ball player he was, who lost 4.5 years to military service at the peak of his career.
Jeez.
And then I have a book coming out with my good friend Bob Drury in October called Valley Forge. And it's the story of George Washington in those 6 months. And our contention is, and I think we back it up with the book, that it is that those 6 months of Valley Forge that saved the American Revolution. Otherwise, we'd be Canada right now.
Wow. Canada.
Some people actually right now might prefer to be Canada.
This is true. How can somebody get in touch with you, by the way?
Beach Reading is my beachreading@gmail.com. And it's as it sounds, as if I was on the beach reading. And I'm not hard to find. I enjoy hearing from people. And if they want to contact me, beachreading@gmail.com.
Fantastic. Tom, it's a pleasure having you on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You've been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people about the places and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, associate broker with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.